This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Dr. Becca Neal lost a patient during a routine operation, and it made a mark on her medical record and her marriage. And, of course, the patient's family grieved their loss, and they decided to sue. That's the plot line of a play, Love Alone, by North Carolina native Deborah Salem Smith. It explores the burden that doctors, patients, and lawyers share following medical accidents. Playmakers Company production of Love Alone opens tonight in Chapel Hill, but first we're joined by the director, Vivian Benesch. Welcome. Good to
have
you here.
Thank you, Frank. So nice to be here.
Tell us about this play and why you were drawn to it in the first place.
You know, there are so many things in this play that are the best of what theater can be. First of all, just on a great story, even if a very sad story, which you just described so beautifully. But it has conflict. It has growth and change. The characters really go through something. We get to witness both doctor and patient's family really go through the process of grieving, of dealing with the different ways in which they compartmentalize or act out in their relationships both at home and professionally, and really come to a conclusion, a new place. And to me, the best theater really takes us on that journey. And this play does that.
Yeah, and it does it in a way that is profound, as you say, and nuanced, because it's easy to take a plot line that centers on a medical error, particularly a fatal error, and turn it into melodrama.
Well, right?
Good guy, bad guy, we're done.
And on television, of course, that is, right, you know, the formula, of course. So it's nice to have a little portion of the formula here, but be very unformulaic in that play, because what Deborah Salem Smith has done so beautifully is not look at one side. But I can't think of other plays or television shows or films that look at the doctor and the patient and their family situations side by side. And literally in this play, it's side by side. There's so much simultaneity in the playing of it as well. So you really get to see characters from different sides or different teams, if you want to put it that way.
Well, tell us about the staging and how that works.
So the staging, well, the play, it's episodic in some ways. There are 26 scenes in the play in a short, just over 2 hours, actually. So it travels to many places, whether it's in hospital waiting rooms, two different families' homes, lawyers' offices, a deposition office, I suppose you could say. So it travels to a hospital parking lot. But all of this in our production is in the envelope of a singular waiting room. Really what a wonderful designer that I've worked with many times, Lee Savage, and I, when we started talking about this play, I really brought something that a line of the play, which is, we're all going to be patients someday. We need every good doctor we can get. And that really spoke to us that we are all going to be patients. We all know that feeling of sitting in a waiting room, whether you're sitting there waiting for one of your loved ones or waiting to go in for a test or an exam, waiting, you know, I just went through that the week before I got here for rehearsals with one of my very closest friends. So we all know it. That's a universal thing. We can latch onto that. So this waiting room, this somewhat realistic waiting room, is our envelope, but it modulates in many, many ways to turn into all these other spaces we need it to be.
And there's a kind of personal connection here, too, because you work closely with the playwright throughout
Indeed.
This production, and she has a personal experience with this. I mean, tell her
Well,
story.
You know, the reason that she wrote this play comes from sort of a lot of different angles, and it's hard to know where to start. There's so many layers to it. But her partner in life is in the medical profession, and they went through med school together. And when her partner Christine was out of med school, she started witnessing all these young, fantastic doctors were inevitably getting sued. And it wasn't a matter of years or times, that it happened much faster than they ever expected. And the trauma that put on the community and on each of them individually of how they had to deal with that was really hard in their professional lives as well as their personal lives. So that was one angle. She was fascinated by that. Then on the other side, her father-in-law is a lawyer who deals in great part with medical malpractice suits. And so she would hear stories from him where she said, really, you felt for these patients' families and the victims of which, where you were like, oh my God, the amount of error happening is so extreme and what these families are going through. So she was caught, literally caught between the two. And the play was born out of trying to look at the gray areas on both sides. And then in her personal life, one of my favorite things in this play is this idea of questioning what forgiveness means. And so, you know, we have in America, and I don't know all the facts behind this, but the amount of money, time, effort spent on medical malpractice, we all know, is just, I think, unequaled anywhere else in the world. And the question is, does it actually serve the healing process? And what is the cost that it takes on both the medical profession as well as the victims and the victims' families' lives?
We brought some actors with you, and we can get a sample of this play, Love Alone, which opens tonight. Tonight or tomorrow?
We start previews tonight.
Previews tonight. And then we
previews tonight. Open on Saturday night.
On Saturday night. Love Alone, Playmakers in Chapel Hill. Let's set up this scene, would you? Jenny Wales is here, and she will play Dr. Becca Neal, and Patrick McHugh is her husband, JP, and maybe you can set up the scene for
us. Yeah, so this scene is at home, and the bad outcome that Dr. Becca Neal experienced is just within a week ago, but she has returned to the hospital for work as usual, but she comes home and her husband is worried about her, and that's what we get to hear a little bit of here.
Guess the news of the day. The head of pediatrics is having an affair with the head of cardiology.
That's the news of the day.
Yeah. A janitor walked in on them having sex in a closet.
A closet? Get out of here.
A broom closet. And they have offices. Nice offices.
So you're fine?
Yes. A little tired. Who wouldn't be covering 9 surgeries?
And how's it been being back?
JP, I've been waiting all day to turn off my brain. Here's your chance. I'm willing to watch one of your remodeling shows. Come on. What channel for the thrill of power tools and termites?
When you started med school, you made me promise.
I know what you're going
to
say.
You saw what happened
it's
to
other doctors.
It's fair
to remind me,
human
but that's not what
off,
I'm doing.
Compartmentalize.
This is different.
Whatever. How, Beck? You're home late again. You keep saying nothing.
What, you need the story?
I don't need the story.
Hendricks finished the surgery.
I don't need the story.
It was time for the patient's breathing tube to come out. It came out. She stopped oxygenating well. I called back in Hendricks. We got the tube back in. Hendricks saw it fogging up. That's good. That's air moving. Still, she spiraled like that, from routine to chaos.
Why?
That's my point. The stars aligned against me, so I spent another day repairing my reputation, dashing around, doing everyone else's work.
Honestly, that's what I'm concerned about.
Don't worry, this is a minor interruption.
Don't say minor.
Temporary, I mean.
This is real. And compartmentalizing.
I'm not compartmentalizing.
Then why are we pretending?
I have other patients. I can't stew. I can't doubt.
This is marriage. 2-person job.
Jenny Wales and Pat McHugh, who are reprising a scene from Love Alone. It starts Saturday night at Playmakers in Chapel Hill. Vivian, who is with us as well, Vivian Benesch, directs this play. I mean, this is a scene that talks about a doctor in denial, and we're going to see the family in some ways in denial.
Yes,
as well.
I mean, the whole other side of this is to see the victim's family dealing with that and dealing with their grief. And her partner of 20 years, Helen, not being able to process it. I mean, this was a routine surgery that went badly And so the ability to process that is sort of taken away from that. And we really watch a mother and daughter sort of navigate that. But what I love, again, about this play is that there's a very, very human side to the doctor's own process or how she processes this event in her life. And I think it's very moving to me and been a balance because we who aren't in the medical profession spend a lot of time sort of wanting to blame and wanting to look for reasons. When tragedy strikes, we look for the reason. We want an explanation. And we deserve it to a degree, but sometimes there isn't one. And sometimes, you know, all of those issues come up here. And I think people are really going to identify with that. And what I love about the scene that we just heard is that this real idea of compartmentalizing and how the relationships with the people who are here now in our life often suffer because we're so caught up in dealing with the loss.
And they could also be part of the healing. So we'll talk more about this play. And the fact is you worked with a real medical doctor in the production of this play. We'll meet that doctor and continue our conversation about the Playmakers Repertory Company production of Love Alone at Paul Green Theater. Previews begin tonight. It opens on Saturday night and it runs through March 16th. We'll talk more about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today talking about Love Alone, a play about medical malpractice and the people it touches. We're with director Vivian Benesch, who is and joined now by UNC anesthesiologist Dr. Ty Bullard. Dr. Bullard's a practicing doctor and a professor of anesthesiology at UNC, and he worked with the cast of Love Alone. Ty, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me in.
Tell us about your role. Why did you decide to participate in this, and what did you do?
Well, our department was approached by the repertory company for some assistance and technical guidance, and that call went out generally to the department. I responded in part because I have I'm a fan of Playmakers and attend quite frequently, but also because I have a particular interest in the humanities as well. And so over the course of one afternoon in particular, but the last week or two have served in the role of technical consultation in terms of some of the medical details that the playwright actually so accurately describes in her script, but also in terms of the emotional impact upon physicians that these tragic and ultimately, over the course of a span of a career, unavoidable events that do occur.
That's interesting. I'd like to take you through the process of that because you're brought in cold. You have some experience in general with this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Kind of what sort of advice did you have initially? And then how did your feelings about this change, if at all, in seeing the play? I mean, what was your thought process about the emotional contact once you'd seen the actual content of this play?
Right. I think probably the advice to answer your first question, the advice that was given was, I think it was largely a function of providing some insight into how mentally and emotionally physicians process tragic errors or simply tragic events that occur without an error ever having taken place. In this particular story, Dr. Neal is involved in a horrible event, the death of a healthy patient, which is a fear for every practicing physician, particularly in the operating room. But it's one in which she can look back and see clear things that she might have done differently. And as, in fact, Jenny and I had a discussion last night discussing about how heavily such instances weigh on the mind of an individual, of a physician who has been a part of a bad outcome, a tragic outcome, and that it colors your interactions minute to minute as you go through the healing process, and often for weeks, months, or years at a time. And while I've not had an event quite so terrible as this one, I've certainly had events where I questioned what I could have done differently, and it colors every part of your life as you move forward. So I think those details, aside from the technical considerations that were that largely didn't need much attention, they were so well done. But that window into the psyche of the physician who has been a part of a tragic outcome and how that progresses towards healing.
But even before that, so much of what you said just now reminds me of conversations I've had with soldiers who have to do kind of the same thing. I mean, they're living in mortal danger, and they have to know that, and they have to act appropriately, but they can't think about it. And so you wonder, how do you do that? How do you know that you have to act differently than just having a cup of coffee and still put it out of your head that what you're about to do could result in your death or the death of someone else?
Right. Unquestionably, it's a trained behavior, and soldiers go through extensive training to basically select and utilize the portions of their brain that that are most appropriate at the given time. And there is a certain amount of emotional distancing that must occur in order for us to provide effective care, particularly in the setting of life-threatening emergencies. And, you know, anesthesiology is a bit unique in one regard in that we take people who are happy, breathing, smiling, talking, cracking jokes, just like the tragic patient was in this particular play. And then we take them into and we intentionally induce a state of helplessness. They're immediately unable to breathe. They're immediately unable to move. They immediately have no control whatsoever over their own bodies. Their own autonomy immediately disintegrates. And in that very moment, we become their agent, both medically, but also from an ethical standpoint. And those are the challenges that an anesthesiologist in particular faces on a day-to-day basis, 8 or 10 times a day.
Well, Vivian, you stressed the kind of human side, the humanity of this play, and you heard Ty talk about the kind of the joke cracking and sometimes I would assume the dark humor that has to keep things going. And this play has plenty of that as well.
Yes, it really does. I just want to say that the time we got to spend with Dr. Bolad was such an inspiring time and gave me huge faith in the medical profession. It really did, because it is our hope that doctors like Dr. Bolad, who take the time, clearly not only with us but with their patients, that kind of time and energy, that you really do sort of understand we are all human and we do tend to sort of put our lives in the hands of doctors and hope that they will play the role of God and everything will go well. And when it doesn't go well, it's you want people like Dr. Bolad on your team either way.
No actors were harmed in the production.
That is correct. No actors were harmed. But that, thank you for bringing up the sort of There is such a humanity in this play and such a joy. I keep saying that the playwright Deborah Salem Smith is actually a real optimist at the end of the day, because she really believes that we can actually grow and change through these tragedies and through communication. There's a lot to be learned, again, both professionally, personally, in the legal profession, in the medical profession, that these we don't need to demonize. And in fact, as we're going through tragedy, there's a lot of necessary laughter to be had. And that maybe if we communicated face-to-face more with the people that we are so separate from, that we'd have a lot less malpractice suits, perhaps.
Well, and pay attention to the nurses. I like the fact that you have a nurse in this role, having been as one who is personally surrounded by nurses all his life, and comes from a long line. I love the role that this nurse plays, because I've watched nurses pull doctors fat out of the fire many times.
Yes, indeed. Well, the nurse
I just
here,
had to get that in.
No, I'm so glad you did, because, you know, there is the wonderful actress Kathy Williams in this production plays not only the nurse, but also the decedent services representative, and then the hospital lawyer. So in these three roles, she's really representing different facets of the hospital personnel there. And they range throughout. Each of them has a very different point of view and brings something. But the nurse is, you know, it's the salt of the earth character, not only as a wonderful release of humor, because she's seen everything, done everything, nothing surprises her, and she knows how to help Dr. Becca Neal through this, but she's also knows what has to get done, and she's sort of a linchpin. There's a scene that we call Deep Throat. We've sort of called it the Deep Throat scene, which really changes the course of the play, because she's willing to put herself on the line to activate change. And so it is a wonderful character. And we, again, something we can all identify with. A great nurse, there is nothing better than a great nurse.
Okay. You heard it first here on the State of Things. The medical profession, of course, the personal lives that are touched, and the legal profession. Malpractice plays an important part in this. And, of course, that is alternately demonized and glorified because there needs to be some lever and some protection against this. And, and then occasionally we see that profession demonized as well.
When patients feel no agency, and their families feel no agency, we are forced to go to the legal profession to help us have that, to find that voice. And, there are cliches of that, being horrible and awful and a huge expenditure of money just and greed and that being about greed. But then there's also a real sense of it also being a necessary advocacy. So, and I think, again, this play touches on, in our case, the lawyer in this play is really there. Mr. Rush takes on the victim's family's case. And in this case, he is, of course, the man who said, as I said before, we're all going to be patients. We need every good doctor we can get. That's his line. So that's the point of view he's coming from. And yet when he needs to be a cutthroat doctor, he is, and there's a wonderful deposition scene, which will, I hope, satisfy all those Law and Order fans out there. But also,
it's in the play.
Well,
can we hear it now, or at least a part of that right now?
Absolutely. This is a part of it. It doesn't really need much explanation because it is the deposition to get the information from the anesthesiologist, from Dr. Becca Neal.
There are discrepancies, as I'm sure you're aware, from what Dr. Hendricks says went on in that operating room. You tell me what you recall.
Yes, sir. When the patient's saturation levels fell...
Look how much paper we waste doing this. Why don't we just start here? Under remarks, you wrote, patient opened eyes on command. So after the surgery, you asked Susan Howell to open her eyes?
Correct.
Why?
It's a step in the process. It's how you know she's ready to be extubated.
And she immediately had problems.
Yes, sir. Her upper airway collapsed on itself. I called back in Dr. Hendricks. We decided to reintubate. After my first attempt, I said, I don't think I'm in. Dr. Hendricks said, you're in. I hear breath sounds.
You listen for breath sounds?
No. The situation deteriorated rapidly. I was trying to reintubate, to administer drugs, and as I was going to say, when her levels fell, I said again, I was adamant, I don't think I'm in. We need a trach. That's how I said it. Just like that. Hendricks said, no, hold off, so I didn't ask again.
You never listened for breath sounds yourself.
I followed rank and protocol to maintain order in the room.
You deferred.
Correct.
Dr. Hendricks testified it's the anesthesiologist's job to determine whether you're in the airway or not.
He's a board-certified
surgeon.
So I
went and found this manual. It says it is the anesthesiologist's job. Hold this. Do you agree now that it's your job?
Yes, if you mean technically.
You testified he was in charge.
Dr. Hendricks is the senior physician.
But now you agree with him.
I agree technically. But in this situation, rank was a factor, as well as physicians with different levels of experience.
Discrepancies. You read Dr. Hendricks' deposition?
I was not.
Wait, I said you read his deposition?
I read. Yes. Sorry, I read it.
These now are Dr. Hendricks' exact words.
Okay.
On one occasion, Dr. Neal suggested a trach.
No, I said four times.
Suggested.
I adamantly requested the trach.
But why be adamant?
What?
You testified you believed Dr. Hendricks when he said the patient was getting air, so why be adamant?
I mean, I relied on Dr. Hendricks. He heard breath sounds and saw air in the tube.
Yes. So you believed him.
Derek Ivey as Mr. Rush, Jenny Wales playing Dr. Becca Neal in Playmaker's production of Love Alone. Previews open start tonight, and it opens Saturday night through March 16th. Also with us here today on the State of Things, Vivian Benish, who is the director of Love Alone, and Dr. Ty Bullard, an anesthesiologist at UNC, who did some consulting on this. And Dr. Bullard, one of the things this raises is this. So now we've got this adversarial situation, and it makes it polarizes the situation. Mm. And here's the one thing people say about these cases is that there's no room for then apology. It's very difficult for anybody to climb down and say, look, I made a mistake and this was a horrible thing, because now it's a legal matter. I mean, have you found yourself, how does that play a part in all of this?
It most definitely plays a role, and the roles and the manners in which these circumstances unfold are as varied as the personalities that you find in the operating room, and it's largely dependent upon that. I've been involved in situations where we've had a poor outcome in the operating room, and a surgeon was frankly unwilling first of all to acknowledge that something went awry, much less to validate those concerns with the patient. Luckily, we find those situations very rarely, and I certainly didn't find – I've never found that at UNC. I'll say that quite clearly. And I've been involved in situations that are completely and entirely the opposite of that and quite contrary to what you'd find in the script here by Ms. Smith, whereby a surgeon and an anesthesiologist would, no matter where the blame ultimately rests, as determined by a legal settlement or otherwise, but that there is a joint approach to validation of the patient's concerns and an apology offered. And I think you've touched on one of the most important things that physicians can concentrate on, or perhaps young physicians can take and learn from a story like this that unfolds in real life so often. And that is that no matter how legally a case might end up, you must put the legal considerations as a backseat. And I think often we do a good job of that, and focus on how does that patient or that patient's family with whom you will speak, how do they perceive this, and give them the opportunity to express their concerns or their frustrations with the process and how it unfolded, and also to understand the very important fact that an apology is very different than an admission of guilt. It's that way legally in the state of North Carolina and many other states that have progressive tort reform laws. But that law is not there to protect physicians from being sued, but it is rather there as a means to give an avenue for physicians to say what, as human beings, they want to say, which is that I'm sorry that this event that I was involved in has caused you pain or caused you suffering. And as human beings, we all want to acknowledge that, and those apologies are important. They're important as a part of the healing for a patient who has been wronged, or a family who's had a loved one that has been wronged, but they're just as important as a healing process for the physician as well. And for the legal constructs to preclude such an apology from being given has been identified largely and across many states as counterproductive
right.
to
as
the
you,
process.
As you point out, in North Carolina, that there is that permission to give an apology and not have it used against you mm-hmm. in the case, and many other states as well. But Vivian, in the play, the grieving family members really do focus on the lawsuit as kind of their remedy. That's their voice,
well,
in a way.
The mother, Helen, ultimately winds up latching onto it as the thing that sort of replaces the empty space. That becomes her obsession. And, you know, we hear that these lawsuits can go on for years mm-hmm. and years. And this play only takes course over a six-month period. But her daughter, Clementine, is a wonderful character, is sort of grew up in this world where both her parents taught her that forgiveness, you don't sue. It wouldn't ever have been a conception. So to watch her mother change her mind and suddenly become a person who sues and becomes obsessed with this lawsuit really takes its toll on their mother-daughter relationship. And again, that's one of the things that the play does so beautifully, is posits that the doctor, and exactly what Dr. Bullard is talking about, with next to the family, going through very different but not unrelated grieving processes.
So without giving away too much, is there hope for reconciliation in this play?
You know, all I'll say is Deborah Salem Smith is an optimist. She may disagree with me, but I strongly believe that. I think there's, you know, the play Love Alone, the title comes from the Edna St. Vincent Millay poem, Love Is Not All. And the poem starts saying, you know, love can't fix my bones. It won't, you know, clean it won't clean me, house me, do anything. But at the end of the day, without love, we have nothing. And so that is indeed the theme of the play.
And without theater, we have nothing. So the hope, if nothing else, expresses the optimism that by playing this out and watching human beings grapple with these seemingly unsolvable problems is the hope itself. And we get to watch it on the stage and then take it home with us. So thank you so much for putting it on. And
it's
thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Vivian Benesch is the director of Love Alone for UNC Playmakers Rep Company. Dr. Ty Bullard, an anesthesiologist and professor of anesthesiology at UNC Chapel Hill. Jenny Wales, Derek Ivey, and Patrick McHugh are actors in Love Alone. That previews tonight at the Paul Green Theater in Chapel Hill, opens Saturday and runs through March 16th. Coming up next, what does the history of evangelicalism have to do with political polarization? Find out on the State of Things. Stay tuned.